Chapter 7. Dirty Money and Clean Art. Van Gogh in the basement, Basquiat in a box. How the art market serves international money laundering. There was definitely something wrong with these prices, even if they were only estimates. A small, typical, signed pastel on cardboard by Joan Miró, just 30,000 euros. A chalk sketch from about 1880 by Edgar Degas for 10,000 euros. A pencil drawing by Amadeo Modigliani for 20,000 euros. A somewhat faded watercolor of Collier France by Henri Matisse for 30,000 euros. All these estimates were just as clearly too low as the 50,000 euros set as the cost of the Pissarro depicting two seated peasant women in his typically vibrant pastel hues. But, in fact, everything was above board and proper with the 55 works by great artists of classic modernism that were sold by the auction house Pandolfini in Florence at the end of October 2019. Even the abstract Kandinsky watercolor of 1913, a somewhat kitschy Chagall gouache of his favorite set pieces, Rooster, Pair of Lovers, and Violin, and a pointillist landscape by Signac, weren't forgeries or works in bad condition, as is usually the case with similarly low estimates. All the pictures were furnished with expert opinions by prominent specialists, could be found in the relevant catalogs of works, or have been traded, during the past decades, by respectable galleries or auction houses. The secret behind the collection, which had been advertised with the title Recovered Treasures, lay with the consignor. These and 123 other works that were offered exclusively online weren't from a private collector, but rather the Italian State Institute for Court Sales, and with very good reason. The 178 works hadn't been missing, nor was it a question of recovered treasures. Quite to the contrary. Anybody could have recognized the paintings, gouaches, watercolors, drawings, and sculptures. In December 2019, some of the most important pictures were even to be seen in the evening news on Italian television. Media in other European countries also reported at the time how carabinieri, in gray uniforms and helmets, gently carried the works into a room at the tax authority. It was apparent that some of them, such as the early Van Gogh still life with apple basket, were reproductions. Others that were paraded before the assembled press were, in fact, originals. These artworks were supposed to have helped a businessman hide money from the state. The plan leaked out, and that's why the tax authorities were auctioning off art in the fall of 2019 at such low prices. 14 billion euros in debts. It was formerly the property of the Italian industrial magnate Callisto Tanzi, who had become a billionaire principally through Parmalat, a food company he founded in 1961. When the company went into bankruptcy in 2003, it had 14 billion euros in debt, as well as 32,000 investors, large and small, who had been harmed. Tanzi was sentenced to 10 years in prison for stock manipulation and corruption, and then in a second proceeding in 2010 to an additional 18 years for fraud and the formation of a criminal enterprise. Parts of his private fortune were still missing until his son-in-law led tax investigators to the basements of three homes in Parma. There, Tanzi had attempted to hide money and property in the form of artworks. When they were found, the media estimated the total value at $100 million, most likely because of the names— Van Gogh, Gauguin, Cézanne, Manet, Degas, Signac, Monet, and Modigliani. In fact, most of the pictures were neither major nor large-format works, which would have made them automatically more expensive. The Italian tax authorities had set the estimated sales prices with corresponding caution, even for the more expensive pictures. A view of Varangeville by Claude Monet, dated 1882, had the modest opening price of 800,000 euros and fetched in the end 1.53 million euros. Similarly, the early Van Gogh still life with apple basket from 1885 had an opening price set at 280,000 euros, and his surprisingly large watercolor of a pollarded window was set at 200,000 euros. There was a bidding war that pushed prices well over the estimates, to 495,000 euros for the still life, and 800,500 euros for the watercolor of the tree. In the online portion of the auction, it was plain that the convicted fraudster, Callisto Tanzi himself, had sometimes been ripped off. Many of the works offered for sale bore the inscription, "Work is not authentic." Pictures allegedly by Giovanni Boldini and Giovanni Fattori, for example, or forged bronzes in the style of De Chirico and Alberto Giacometti. The supposed Giacometti female figure, for example, was offered for just 800 euros, for the benefit of the Italian treasury and the victims of Parmalat. Art is attractive for money laundering. If money laundering is defined as the attempt, through purchases and sales, to give illegally acquired money the appearance of being completely legitimate, then Callisto Tanzi isn't an isolated case. In all big disclosures about hiding fortunes illegally, whether they're called the Panama Papers, Paradise Papers, Bahamas Leaks, Offshore Leaks, or Russian Laundromat, investing dirty money in art plays a substantial role. In his treatise, Money Laundering Through Art, the Brazilian judge, criminologist, and money laundering expert, Fausto Marchingi Sanctis, explains why transactions in art have come to play an increasingly important role in money laundering in the past few years. Art is an attractive sector for the practice of money laundering because of the large monetary transactions involved, the general unfamiliarity and confidentiality surrounding the art world, and the unlawful illegal activity endemic to it, theft, robbery, and forgery. Gisanctis points out that neither this business sector itself nor the society at large has a sufficient awareness of the problem. Indeed, repeated tolerance of illegal activity in the art world, which is known to be widespread, undermines the market and its credibility to the extent that authorities have been unable to properly enforce the good practices required by both the law and the will of society. Concrete examples from the past few years prove these observations to be correct. For instance, a packing crate at Kennedy Airport in 2007 seemed customs personnel, as it was about to be shipped off as freight, to be too large and too expensive for what it was supposed to contain. An artwork valued at $100, said the packing papers from London, where it was to be sent. No title or artist was named. The search that was ordered revealed that the box actually held a 1982 painting by the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat, 152 centimeters by 152 centimeters in size, acrylic and collage paper on linen, which was attached to wooden stretcher bars at each end. Minimum value, $8 million. The valuable picture was one of about 1,200 works that the Brazilian banker F. had purchased. According to law enforcement authorities, these purchases were made with money that he had withdrawn from investor funds of Banco Santos and embezzled. When his system collapsed in 2004, F. left behind debts of $1 billion. Before he was sentenced 2 years later to 21 years imprisonment for bank fraud, tax evasion, and money laundering, this banker was able to smuggle at least $30 million worth of art out of Brazil. F. and his wife had bought many of the works, such as the Basquiat painting, through a firm named Broadening Info Enterprises, which was registered in Panama. This enterprise later attempted to resell the pictures in the art market. Where that succeeded, illegally acquired money was washed clean through art, and its origin could no longer be determined. You can have a transaction where the seller is listed as private collection, and the buyer is listed as private collection. In any other business, no one would be able to get away with this, elucidated Sharon Cohen-Levin, the head of the Division for Asset Forfeiture of the New York U.S. Attorney's Office. In particular, since the prices in art sales are set at will, how much an owner asks for a Basquiat picture and how much the prospective buyer is ready to pay depends primarily on good old supply and demand, which in the art market plays out with respect to a unique object that cannot be compared with anything else. The result has been the huge auction records of the past few years. Even the few spectacular price records that leak into the public realm from discreet private deals suggest that there are no upper limits, including allegedly $300 million for Paul Gauguin's Tahitian painting, Nafea Fa Ipo Ipo, from the Stechelin collection, and $320 million for Paul Cézanne's Card Players, from the Embiricos collection. On the other hand, in none of these cases can it be proved that these prices were actually paid, and not just the stuff of rumors. Picasso, Matisse, and Damien Hirst. The art dealer Matthew G., whose father owns a gallery in London, was accused by the U.S. Department of Justice of having participated in an ongoing fraud for many years. It was a question of money laundering. According to the criminal investigation, two managers at the investment firm Beaufort Securities had defrauded its investors through illegal market manipulations. The unlawful gains were laundered through the art market, among other methods, as described in the comprehensive 29-page criminal indictment. Named by the British press as a friend of Prime Minister Boris Johnson, G was unmasked in London at a February 2018 meeting with someone he thought was a new client. In fact, the client was an investigator wearing a wire who claimed that he had profited from illegal stock market manipulations. According to the indictment, G offered to sell the investigator the 1965 Picasso painting Personnage for $6.7 million. After a certain amount of time, G was to resell the painting and afterwards transfer the $6.7 million through a U.S. bank to the man's bank account. The undercover detective indicated quite openly that he wanted to launder money this way. In the opinion of the investigators, G had thereby become an accomplice. In May 2019, his gallery went bankrupt. The art dealer flew to Spain, where he underwent treatment in a clinic for substance abuse. Legal proceedings have not yet begun. On May 11, 2009, the former attorney Mark Dreyer confessed to fraud and money laundering. Like the notorious Bernie Madoff and his $65 billion fraud, Dreyer had, over a period of 5 years, defrauded professional investors, such as hedge funds, with forged debt instruments to the tune of $400 million. The fortune earned by this scam was laundered by acquiring art, among other things. A list of his assets from the New York District Attorney encompasses more than 150 works, among them paintings by Alex Katz, Red Tulips, 1967, Roy Lichtenstein, First Painting with Bottle, 1975, Agnes Martin, Loving Love, 2000, Mark Rothko, Untitled, 1957-63, and 9 canvases by Andy Warhol. Apparently, no one ever asked Dreyer where he got the money that he paid the galleries and auction houses. Sales through Panama. The story of the Greek family named Goulandris is to be found in the Panama Papers. They are one of many shipping dynasties that invest their fortunes in, among other things, art collections, which are administered through offshore firms they are associated with. In this way, the assets are at least partially removed from governmental scrutiny. Basil Goulandris and his wife Elise were always willing to lend out their pictures. The two owned paintings that some museum directors would kill for. Their collection included a self-portrait by Cézanne, one of the renowned views of the Rouen Cathedral, painted by Monet, abstracts by Kandinsky and Klee, a portrait triptych by Francis Bacon, a drip painting by Jackson Pollock, and a half dozen major works by Vincent van Gogh, such as the famous Still Life with Coffee Pot, one version of the Olive Pickers, and Les Aliscans, his painting of the ancient Roman necropolis in Arles. Over the course of half a century, the two had gathered over 200 works, valued altogether at $500 million. In constant competition with his fellow countrymen Stavros Niarchos, George Embiricos, and Aristotle Onassis, Basil Goulandris captured headlines in 1957 when he paid what was then a record price of $297,000 for A Still Life with Apples by Gauguin. Almost everything that followed was of museum quality. For example, one of the last pictures that Cézanne painted of his garden shortly before his death in 1906. As photos show, many of the paintings hung in Goulantris's chalet in Gstaad, Switzerland, during the winter months, and then in the summer the pictures were moved to his villa in Lausanne, or brought to a storage facility. Those who needed paintings for a retrospective or thematic exhibition could count on the support of this Greek couple who resided in Switzerland. In the summer of 1999, a year before her death, Elise Goulantris decided to exhibit the major works publicly for 3 months in a small, radiant, white art museum on the island of Andros in the Cyclades that the couple themselves had had built. They rarely sold work during their lifetime, though a duplicative cathedral painting by Monet was sold in 1990 through the Basel gallery Beiler to the collection of the Japanese security company Nomura. Two versions of the same motif appeared to be too great a luxury, even for a billionaire. Basil Goulantris, who had made his money with the tankers of the Orion Shipping and Trading Company, had maintained close connections to the Greek military regime before democratization, died in April 1994 at the age of 81. His wife survived him by 6 years. Before their deaths, both had decided that the core of their collection should be shown someday in Athens. The architect Yeo Ming Pei was hired for the building. The size was to be 10,000 square meters and to cost approximately 27 million euros. The Greek state provided a piece of land for the construction, but it had to stop early when in fall 1996, workers doing the excavation encountered walls of a lyceum in which Aristotle was supposed to have taught his students. Another location was abandoned after protests by neighbors. In 2009, the Goulantris Foundation, which had been created 3 decades earlier to shepherd the collection, announced the purchase of a neoclassical building on Eratosthenes Street in the Pangrati neighborhood, though it was only 7,000 square meters large. The Goulantris Museum would supposedly be ready in 2012. Then ensued the threatened bankruptcy of the Greek state, drastic cutbacks and higher taxes. The Goulantris Museum finally opened in October 2019, but only with part of the original collection. Some pictures had been sold in the meantime. Opaque transactions. A niece of this collector couple, Aspasia Zaimis, sued in Switzerland because she believed that the intent of her aunt had been disregarded and she feared that pictures could have been sold in secret. Elise Goulantris, who was childless, was supposed to have ordered that all her personal possessions that were not sufficiently ancient or otherwise suitable for a museum should be kept by her nieces and nephews. Instead, as Zaimis, who stood to inherit a sixth of the estate, claimed in speaking with Bloomberg News, numerous works had disappeared. The report cited an agreement, dated 1995, in which Basil Goulantris was supposed to have sold 83 works to a Panamanian firm named Wilton Trading S.A. for a total of only $31.7 million, i.e., well below market value. Basil Goulantris's sister-in-law, Maria, who died in 2005, had formerly owned Wilton Trading S.A., which had been founded in 1981, but didn't name directors until 1995, as her son, Peter John Goulantris, attested before the Swiss court. His uncle had needed money to pay debts. That's why the price was acceptable to him. Besides, he said, his sister, Marie Doda Varidis, had agreed that the works that were sold could remain hanging in the chalet belonging to Basil and Elise Goulantris in Gstaad. Some of these works were to be transferred in the middle of 1992 to a foundation called Sirina, registered in Vaduz, Liechtenstein. From the perspective of the litigant Aspasia Zaimis, various facts contradict this representation. An expert opinion of the Lausanne Public Prosecutor's Office was said to have found that the 1985 contract was drawn up on paper that was not available until 1988. Basil Goulantris, who had Parkinson's disease, was no longer capable of signing in 1988. Bloomberg reported that Basil Gulandris was named in 1993 as the owner in the insurance documentation for the loan of the Miro painting Paysage, La Sauterelle, in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and not Wilton Trading S.A., which had allegedly purchased it 8 years earlier. And in the 1999 exhibition on Andros of works by Bacon, Balthus, Bonnard, Braque, Cézanne, Ernst, Gauguin, Giacometti, Van Gogh, Kandinsky, Klee, Léger, Miró, Monet, Picasso, Pollock, Rodin, and Toulouse-Lautrec, plus an edition of the Degas sculpture Little 14-Year-Old Dancer, nothing indicated that they weren't the property of Basil and Elise Gulandris. Zaimis's co-heirs, her sister and four other nieces and nephews, contradicted her claims through a common lawyer. Everything was in order, countered the executor of the will of Elise Gulandris, Kyriakos Koutsamalis, whom the Swiss authorities were investigating on suspicion of misrepresentation of ownership and the transmission of forged documents. Even Peter John Gulandris, one of the co-inheritors, stated through his attorney, "There is a piece of land for the museum and advanced plans and preparations for the construction. The paintings at issue here were a part of a private transaction between Basil Gulandris and Wilton Trading S.A. about 10 years before his death. In fact, works were sold after the death of Basil and Elise Gulandris that were not ancient, to be sure, but were so museum-worthy that every museum director would clear a wall right away to make space to show them. The New York art dealer Alexander Apsis handled the sale of the 1980 Vincent van Gogh double portrait Two Children, painted shortly before his death, to the owner of the investment firm Perpetual Corporation, Joseph Allbritton in Washington, D.C., for example. He owed his fortune to, among other things, business with the regime of the Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. The rumored purchase price stood at $17 million. Apsis also negotiated the sale of Van Gogh's late still life vase with zinnias from the Gulandris collection to a private collection. Other paintings pop up in the Panama Papers because they were plainly also sold through firms registered overseas specifically for that purpose. Van Gogh's 1888 still life with basket and oranges thus found its way in 2005 through the offices of Alexander Apsis and the gallery Heather James in Palm Desert to the California collection of a direct marketing tycoon and his wife. The seller was a firm by the name of Jacob Portfolio Incorporated. Similarly, in 2005, several more Gulandris paintings were offered by Sotheby's. The consigners were once again various companies. Tricorno Holdings for Pierre Bonnard's nude Dans le Cabinet de Toilette. Heredia Holdings for Marc Chagall's Les Comédiens, and Talara Holdings for his Le Violoniste Bleu. According to research by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, all these entities were established just before the transactions and were closed soon thereafter. The common owner of all four companies? Marie Doda Varidis. Shopping for Art Like Mr. Lowe. Eileen M. Decker, the U.S. Attorney for the Central District of California in Los Angeles, made headlines in the summer 2016 when she presented an impressive list of artworks. Even more impressive were the prices that a single customer had paid the auction house Christie's 3 years earlier, inside of just 6 months. The buyer didn't have long to enjoy the collection, which from the beginning was acquired purely as an investment vehicle. In July of that year, the Swiss police seized parts of it from a duty-free warehouse at Cointrin Airport in Geneva. The art acquisitions contributed significantly to a crisis of state in Malaysia. In Switzerland, the financial market authorities were investigating several banks. One of them, Tessiner Bank BSI, was dissolved by Swiss banking regulators in May 2017. The anonymous purchaser, of whom at first it was known only that he came from Asia, began modestly in May 2013 with relatively cheap buys at the benefit auction 11th Hour for Leonardo DiCaprio's environmental nonprofit, LDF. There, this unknown person paid $717,000 for Mark Ryden's Bee Queen and $367,500 for the painted text work Bliss Bucket by Ed Ruscha. In addition, he won bids for two sculptures by Alexander Calder, a standing mobile for $5.4 million, and the work Tic-Tac-Toe for $3 million. 2 days later, he drew down mightily on the customer account, number XXX7644, that he had set up only days before at Christie's in the name of a Tanor Finance Corporation. Just at the New York auction for contemporary art, which set a record for total sales at a single auction of $495 million and carved its place in the history of the art market, he paid $48.8 million, a record price then, for the painting Dust Heads by Jean-Michel Basquiat. 6 weeks later, on June 28th, there followed direct purchases from Christie's of a Concerto Speciale Attese by Lucio Fontana, and the color field painting Untitled, Yellow and Blue, by Mark Rothko, for a total price of $79.5 million. The money wasn't from a family fortune. And merrily it rolled along. For the multi-million dollar sales at the New York Impressionist auction in the first week of November 2013, this top customer had reserved a skybox for 12 in Rockefeller Center, prompting a Christie's employee to email a colleague, "It better look like the Las Vegas casino, Caesar's Palace, in there. The box is almost more important for the client than the art." From the perch of his private lounge above the auction room, this big, mysterious buyer snapped up Van Gogh's pen-and-ink drawing of the Yellow House in the southern French city of Arles for $5.5 million. He concluded his buying trip a week before Christmas when he paid $35 million for Monet's view of Venice, Saint Georges Majeur, at SNS Fine Art from the art-dealing Namad family. The sun-filled picture had previously been exhibited at the Art Institute of Chicago. At Sotheby's in London just a half year later, in June 2014, he followed up with the purchase of Monet's waterlily painting L'Enfer avec reflet de hautes herbes for $33.8 million. The art purchases by the presumed Asian buyer added up to $250 million. He had most of the works delivered quickly to a duty-free warehouse in Geneva. The two Monets and the Van Gogh drawing were seized there in July 2016. After the matter was investigated, it was soon clear to the U.S. attorney that the Malaysian investor and alleged billionaire, Joe Lowe, was the man behind Tanor Finance Corporation. Lowe had already attracted attention for many years with spectacular acquisitions of art and real estate in Beverly Hills and New York. According to the investigation, the money came not from a private fortune, but rather from a multi-billion dollar state fund by the name of One Malaysia Development Berhad, 1MDB. The Malaysian state had in fact created the fund to support development projects. Meanwhile, it proved to be the case that persons in the inner circle of the Malaysian Prime Minister, Najib Razak, had diverted more than $1 billion from the state fund through sham purchases of shares. According to the investigation, even shortly after the first transactions of 1MDB, $500 million was transferred to an account that Lowe controlled. From there, transfers were made to other accounts that in part belonged to Lowe's relatives. The head of state was similarly implicated. His wife was said to have received, among other things, a necklace of 22-carat diamonds worth almost $30 million. Najib Razak later claimed that the large sums in his bank account were a gift of the Saudi royal family. In fact, however, the transfers could be traced back to Tanor, the company through which Joe Lowe had distributed embezzled state funds. Najib Razak was voted out of office in May 2018, and 2 months later he was taken into custody on suspicion of embezzlement and money laundering. At his residences, artworks, luxury goods, and cash worth $300 million were impounded. The investigators found another $700 million in a bank account belonging to Najib Razak, against whom numerous legal proceedings are currently underway. In December 2019, he pled innocent before the court in Kuala Lumpur. The art buys that Joe Low made with state funds serve no other purpose than money laundering, according to the investigations. Low's assignment was to spend the embezzled state money in the largest possible amounts. As studies have consistently found in the past few years in Switzerland, the U.S., Brazil, and Germany, art is especially well-suited for money laundering, along with real estate and expensive yachts. The Basel Institute on Governance, a non-profit research group, issued a warning in 2012 about the large number of illegal and suspicious transactions in the art sector. 2 years later, Monika Roth, a Swiss attorney and professor for compliance and the law of financial markets at the Hochschule Lausanne, as the Federal Institute of Technology Lausanne is known, was more concrete as she made plain, "It was found that there was a strong correlation between the illegal trade in drugs and weapons and money laundering and art crime." The independent researcher named a reason for this startling association of dirty businesses and the presumably noble trade in the good, the beautiful, and the true, art. It is entirely reasonable to conclude that antiquities and art are well suited to money laundering, simply because enormous cash payments are not at all unusual, and crazy sums are moving around. The secrets of the market. No one in the art world has to justify paying 30 times as much for a Van Gogh drawing or a picture by Monet than what the work sold for 5 years earlier. The market has changed, and a naturally anonymous competitive bidder has driven the price up. Whether the competitor in fact exists cannot be proved. For decades in the auction houses, the so-called chandelier bid was acceptable and customary. In order to drive the final price up as high as possible, the auctioneer simply claimed, after looking up at the chandelier, that someone in the back of the room had just raised a hand to bid. Sellers and buyers, through straw men, can be the same person in an art auction. Sometimes all it takes is a quick look at the auction book on the rostrum, the auction podium, and then the announcement that there is a written offer registered to drive the price artificially higher. Even today, there is no way to validate such claims. Still less subject to verification are transactions that occur in private, when allegedly competing interests come into play. Many auction houses long ago established specialized departments for these private sales, and those who are not selling might also put up a piece of art bought with illegally obtained money as collateral for a loan, and then not seek to redeem the artwork. There might be a financial loss in the transaction. But even if they receive half of the value of a painting or sculpture, they now have clean money to spend. These practices were supposedly built up through tradition as trade secrets of the business of buying and selling art. Business practices that don't exist in any other part of international commerce and can include frequent cash payments, which might be ideally suited to the needs of individuals and organized crime alike, as Monika Roth concludes. With its culture of discretion and opacity, the art market cannot be easily regulated. The identification of art objects is hard. The value of objects is difficult to determine because of subjective factors. There are massive amounts of money at play. Money laundering influences the value of objects, which causes market manipulation. Tax evasion in this arena is the order of the day. The transactions are conducted in secret. The parties can remain anonymous or might even be virtual. Auctions can be easily manipulated. Roth is clear that the art market as such cannot and should not be put in the same category as organized crime. She has found, however, that such organizations use the art market and those who conduct art transactions with corrupt dictators who have never earned money legitimately must be open to the accusation that they didn't do their homework and didn't take all the necessary steps to satisfactorily complete the transaction. So it can still be said of the art market, there is no supervisor, there are no rules. Unlike in most financial markets, in the art market, lack of transparency is still the norm. Everybody is making their own rules as they deem fit, preferably none. The New York Times put it this way: In the United States, federal money laundering statutes apply to nearly every major transaction through which illegal profits are disguised to look legal. Typically, dirty money is laundered through the purchase of, say, a penthouse apartment, or mixed in with the earnings of a legitimate business like a restaurant. When gambling winnings or drug proceeds come out the other end, they appear as a real estate asset or business profit. They look clean. Roll up a canvas, and it is easy to stash or move between countries. Prices can be raised or lowered by millions of dollars in a heartbeat, and the names of buyers and sellers tend to be guarded zealously, leaving law enforcement to guess who was involved, where the money came from, and whether the price was suspicious. There is oversight in most of these areas. Real estate transactions and deeds require at least a name. Mortgage brokers, securities brokers, casinos, banks, and Western Union are required to report suspicious financial activities to the government network overseeing financial crimes. Banks must report all transactions of $10,000 or more. This network of brokers, casinos, and banks logs more than 15 million currency transactions each year, which can help trace dirty money, said its spokesperson Steve Hudak. The art market lacks these safeguards. The lack of awareness. The quantitative research of Professor Kai D. Busman, a legal expert who heads up the Interdisciplinary Economy and Crime Research Center at Martin Luther University in Wittenberg, Halle, Germany, helps to explain the lack of awareness of the dangers of money laundering within the art world. He writes, "A very high risk of money laundering exists likewise in the business sector of expensive luxury and consumer goods. An interesting segment is the trade in art and antiquities, which in 2015 boasted a sales volume of over 2 billion euros. This market is, of course, much smaller than the real estate market, but extraordinarily attractive for money laundering. Expensive art objects have the quality of an easily convertible currency, and cash payments are common and plainly favored." The Economy and Crime Research Center adds that the risks of money laundering are greatest if the investments of suspicious funds satisfy several of the following criteria. Characteristics of a currency, easily convertible and stable. Inconspicuousness of converting large sums or values, buying and selling. Possibility of high acquisition price for the good, such as real estate or art. Possibility of significant increase in value. Large cash transactions are possible. For example, construction projects managed by real estate developers, architects, the hotel and restaurant industries, as well as specially established import and export firms. According to independent researchers, among the commercial sectors that meet these criteria, apart from businesses with fiduciary accounts and escrow accounts held by legal advisors and financial consultants, the hotel and restaurant industries and real estate is the trade in expensive art objects and antiquities. Moreover, Professor Busman's research emphasizes the awareness of the problem is woefully inadequate in the art market. Of the art and antiquities dealers and auction houses and galleries questioned, 27% said that they frequently or sometimes accept cash payments of over 15,000 euros. Only about two-thirds, 64%, of the deals identify the counterparty to the transaction or the beneficiary. The remaining transactions are conducted more or less on a handshake, without the dealer or auctioneer knowing from whom they receive these large cash payments. Similarly, about two-thirds of the art and antiquities dealers, auction houses, and galleries surveyed, 65%, assume that the risk of money laundering in their field is small or non-existent. The results of the study show that this self-evaluation has little to do with reality. For this group of dealers, the volume of money laundering might be substantially greater than we could estimate in the study because of the very low level of awareness about the issue. There are very few controls, which makes it highly improbable that deficiencies in fulfilling the duties of due diligence might be discovered. Within the subgroup of businesses selling goods, We found the risks in the sector of fine art and precious antiquities to be by far the greatest. The awareness of the problem is completely insufficient in this group. The same can be said of dealers in boats and yachts, but as a consistent route for money laundering and a hub for large cash transactions, expensive art and antiquities are the best, since all the criteria for goods that are vulnerable to money laundering are squarely met. Art and antiquities are not only especially effective for cultural development as well as generating social capital, but, in contrast to consumer or luxury goods, the risk of money laundering in art and antiquities arises from their unlimited capacity to function as currency with a high degree of global mobility, stable value, and inconspicuousness. The beneficiary, organized crime. Criminals worldwide have profited for some time from the plainly undeveloped awareness of wrongdoing and absent or unused monitoring mechanisms. When in fall 2016, the Italian police raided the house of a drug dealer in the Camorra stronghold of Castellammare di Stabia in the Gulf of Naples, they came upon two early works by Vincent van Gogh that thieves had been hired to steal from the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam in 2002. In the meantime, the paintings had changed hands several times, for money laundering purposes and as currency to pay for drug deals. In America, the FBI suspects that the mafia is behind the spectacular robbery of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston in 1990, in which paintings by Vermeer, Rembrandt, Manet, Degas, and others were stolen. Drug dealing and money laundering are also behind the 2004 theft of Edvard Munch's world-famous painting, The Scream, in Oslo. The dirty business in pictures operates worldwide. When the Japanese economy was booming in the mid-1980s, the art market there boomed as well. In the expensive Ginza district of Tokyo alone, 300 new galleries opened. Between 1985 and 1990, the import of Western art increased 20-fold, $40 million for Van Gogh's Sunflowers, $82.5 million for his portrait of Dr. Gachet, $78.2 million for Renoir's Bal du Moulin de la Galette. In those 5 years, Japanese corporations, banks, and collectors bought art for a total of $3.6 billion before the art bubble burst. An FBI report found that various galleries were associated with Japanese organized crime, Yakuza. Art market experts suspect that during this time period, up to 90% of the money in the Japanese art market came from dubious sources. The entrepreneur Yasumichi M., for example, whom the Japanese media have dubbed the king of dark money, allegedly bought hundreds of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist paintings in New York for about $1 billion. Among them, more than 20 Renoirs and also works by Van Gogh, Monet, Degas, Vuillard, and Gauguin, plus the two early Picassos, Maternité and Au Lapin Agile. Besides that, he also acquired a 6.5% share in the auction house Christie's. After 1990, many Japanese buyers had to part with their artworks, and the pictures and sculptures discreetly returned to the galleries and auction houses at significantly lower prices. In China, the prices for art rose more than 300% between 2009 and 2011. It is noteworthy that many young Chinese collectors at art fairs such as Art Basel Hong Kong are interested in Western art.